Access number 28654, Mr. Leslie Gilbert, Reel 4. Now, so what's the next thing? You're all ready to go. You've been prepared, vaccinated, yes. Everything else. What happens next?
Then we are transferred up to Glasgow. And I'm, as far as I can remember, I'm a train during the night and then straight onto a ship. The name of the ship was the Orangi, I think. I'll just look it up. I've got some papers here. The A-O-R-A-N-G-I. It had been a New Zealand liner, cruise liner. It was probably built to take about a couple of hundred passengers. In fact, it had 3,000 of us, and of course we slept in hammocks.
And this is July, is it?
Yes.
This is the date you know. You said you had to work.
Yes, I've actually got the sailing date that we can come to. We slept in hammocks. We were more than cheek by jowl. Sleeping quarters were the same as the messing quarters. You slept up above the tables. You took your hammocks down every day and rolled them up. It was intensely overcrowded.
What was it like down there? For you? I mean, I suppose you get seasick as well. That way, since you did.
In those days, oddly enough, apart from that flying incident, I wasn't.
So that's a late thrill.
Yeah. One of the unpleasant things was, for security reasons, the portholes were were closed all the time, so you had no light and not very much ventilation either. I wouldn't say that conditions were awful, but I mean, in those days, you could, you know, when you were young and during the war, you could put up with anything. We sailed. I remember we sailed down the Clyde and a certain way, then we messed around for quite a while, a whole day I think, degaussing the ship. Now, when a steel ship is built, all the hammering in the Earth's magnetic field turns the ship into a magnet. And if the ship then passes over a magnetic mine laid on the seabed by the enemy, it will detonate the mine. It's therefore necessary to counteract the magnetism of the ship. This was done by putting a thick cable right round the ship and putting a direct current through it of sufficient intensity to exactly, one hoped, counteract, neutralise the magnetism of the ship. So this was done, and there were tugs that moved the ship round into various angles, just to check.
And you obviously took an interest in this.
I did. Oh yes, this interested me very much. Then we moved down the Clyde, and I remember thousands of men and women, civilians, coming out to cheer us as we went down. I suppose they were from factories and shipyards. All waving us goodbye. It was very patriotic in those days, not like when we returned. And I remember a young woman standing on the quay and lifting her skirt so it was just above her knee, and thousands of men cheering her. We were constituted into a convoy consisting of, I find this quite remarkable really, looking back at the details, 9 troop ships carrying 22,644 troops, 3 store ships, and I recall they had tanks on deck as well as whatever they had below deck, and 11 warships to 12 civilian ships. We sailed on the 30th of July. We were told to sleep in our uniforms.
1942, just to check.
42, 30th of July, 42, yeah. We were told to sleep in our uniforms in case we were torpedoed. And we went out into the Atlantic westwards. Quite shortly afterwards, we ran into a thick fog. While we were in the fog, we heard a plane coming over us. Certainly our ship and possibly others had been rigged up with ropes all the way round the deck with a Bren gunner in between every pair of vertical stanchions. Plane came over, one of the gunners on my ship caught a sudden brief sight of it, let fire with it, fly with his Bren gun, brought the plane down. It was a Sunderland flying boat, which was supposed to be patrolling us and must have had instructions not to fly over the convoy but round it, but somehow got lost and flew over and was shot down. I've been to the what was called the Public Record Office, the Q, the National Archive, and I managed to find some papers there. Would you like the references?
Not for the thing, but we'll put it in the file.
So the story was there. I mean, we ordinary ranks were told nothing at all about what happened. Probably the officers were. The Sunderland came down on the sea a few miles away. Didn't actually crash. The pilot managed to land it, or it was disabled in some way. There were 12 crew, air crew. 11 of them scrambled up and sat on top of it. One of the 12th one somehow was thrown on into the sea, swam away a bit to grab a bit of the plane that had been broken off, one of the underwing floats. The Sunderland started taking water, with these 11 chaps sitting on top, waiting for one of the warships to come and rescue them. It had obviously been carrying depth charges that were armed, and they went off, and that was the end of the 11. The 12th man, who was floating away, was picked up, and in the file that I looked up, there was a brief report by him with a note that he'd been so shocked he couldn't say much more. So we'd shot down one of our own aircraft. A replacement Sunderland was sent out the next day, and somehow or other it managed to crash itself. So two Sunderlands were lost, one on the 31st of July and the next one on the 1st of August. And I read in the paper a few months ago that altogether 26 Sunderlands were built, so we accounted for two of them.
How were things on the voyage for you in these very crowded conditions below decks? It's a fair way you're going, isn't it?
Well, we went right round the Cape of Good Hope, you see, to the Middle East, because the Mediterranean was closed.
I presume you went right out. Normally, they went right out across the Atlantic as well.
I don't know. Well, we went a fair way out. I have looked up the positions of the convoy in the files. I don't think we went. I went out about as far west as the Azores, I think.
What was the trip like for you?
Well, it was enormously crowded. To give you some idea, after breakfast, we all had to go up on deck while the captain did a ship's inspection. And unless you got up very quickly, there was nowhere to sit. And I don't mean benches, I mean sitting on the deck. There were so many men that after a while, you could only stand up. What made it worse was that you could see the deck further forward, which was reserved for the officers, which was just about empty, and they would walk up and down taking their exercise. We got on. You just had to give and take.
The food all right?
The food was quite good, yes. There was hot water, which was something for me, because I'd often lived without running hot water, but you had to wash in seawater with seawater soap, which is highly very unpleasant. You end up terribly sticky. There was total blackout at night, but complete blackout. If anybody had dared to smoke on deck, he would have been shot. And this led to one of my most cherished memories, actually, because there we were in this convoy with not a gleam of man-made light. The stars were indescribable. I just never realized there were so many stars. The sky was embedded with stars, and they seemed so close that you could reach up and get hold of them, like jewels in the sky. I think very few people now would ever have that experience.
So what next?
What next? We called in to Cape Town to take on, Freetown, to take on water. We were there for about 4 days.
Did you get ashore? Or
No. The climate was awful. It was like a steam bath all the time. Africans would come out in their rowing boats and to sell us, I don't know, pineapples or what, fruit of various kinds. They'd chuck the stuff up and we would chuck money down. And so we were there for about 4 days. Then we went off again to Cape Town. Approaching Cape Town, apparently there was a convoy already in, so we couldn't go in. We had to wait outside, and the sea was appallingly rough, and even our big ship was rolling madly from side to side. Now, I wasn't sick, and I remember one occasion when almost everybody else was ill, and I went down, and I was eating the food that was put out for them to eat as well as my own. We had 2 days ashore at Cape Town.
What do you think of that?
Well, I saw very little of it. We were marched around, which was quite sensible. You know, we were taken out for a long march. It felt very odd being on firm ground. I was invited out for a meal. A lot of us were invited out by different families. I was invited out with one other chap to one of the suburbs. All I can remember was that the food was very good and the people were very kind. After that, we were off again. And then the convoy split, and some of them went to India, I think. We went up to Aden, the rest of us. And then, after that, my ship went by itself, no longer needing to be protected, up the Red Sea. We really put the speed on then. I should mention that looking in the files, I discovered that the commodore of the convoy had complained to the Admiralty about two of the storeships, which could only do about 9 or 10 knots, which was slower than the speed that their owners had quoted in order to get the contracts, of course. And that slowed down the whole convoy. After Aden, we steamed up very fast, towing a kite on a long cable as a protection from a diving aircraft until we got to Port Suez, isn't it, at the southern end, I think, of the canal.
Port Suez or Port Tewfik? It's Port Suez.
Tewfik, that's right, yes.
And what you disembarked then?
Yes.
And what were your first impressions of, well, Egypt, Port Tewfik?
I don't remember Port Tewfik. I remember the climate was very hot and very dry. And it's the kind of thing that suits me. I love the heat. It was remarkably dry. The air was extraordinarily clear. It was just desert.
Where were you sent?
What was called a personnel holding centre or some such, I can't remember, not all that far from Tewfik, I don't think, waiting to be posted to whatever unit we were assigned to. After a little while, I can recall one thing there, that there was a range of hills, and I thought I would walk to them, and I said that to one of the sergeant who'd been there for some time. He said, "Do you know how far they are away?" I said, 3 miles, 4 miles, 20. The atmosphere was so clear. Then I was posted.
And what were you doing in this holding camp?
Just hanging around, waiting to be sent for. And eventually I was posted, and a small open-backed truck turned up, 1,500-weight truck, an officer and a driver, and another chap and I were put in the back And the officer said, I don't know whether he was being serious or not, if you see a low-flying aircraft, bang on the cab and we'll all jump out and lie on the ground, because it'll be one, it'll be an attacker. May have been true for all I know. So I got to this new unit, wherever it was, I can't remember.
And who were they?
Well, it was a squadron of some kind. And the next morning, I went along to the workshop, and the sergeant in charge took me to a bench where there was a piece of equipment and said, right, Gilbert, service that. I said, that? Never seen it in my life before. What do you mean? You're a radio mechanic and you don't recognise that. I said, I'm a radar mechanic. And they'd sent me all the way from England, right round the Cape of Good Hope, as a radio mechanic instead of a radar mechanic. So I went back to this holding place again, until eventually I was posted to a squadron which had radar, 458, Royal Australian Air Force.
That was the squadron?
That was the squadron. They were virtually all Australians.
And where were they?
Where?
Whereabouts?
Somewhere in Egypt. Don't remember.
Near Cairo? Or?
Fairly near Cairo, I think. They were a mad lot, these Australians. But they didn't stand for any kind of nonsense from officers or anybody else. The food was extremely good. And after a bit...
Now, tell us a bit more about what they were like. What were the Australian lads like? You know, what was your first impression of them? Because they're quite different in some of the ways they behave, or they were then.
Well, they were very matey, very free and easy. As I said, didn't stand for any kind of disciplinary nonsense, drank like anything, and I'll tell you something else about them in a little while, which really shows what they were like. This, by the way, was round about the time of Alamein.
That would be October.
Yeah, and I think most of the people on our convoy were heading off for Montgomery, and the tanks as well. Then... I'm piecing together what we weren't told at the time. After a bit, after the breakthrough at Alamein, five of our Wellington planes were sent up to an airfield just outside Benghazi in Libya called Berka, B-E-R-K-A. A detachment with 40 men. I was one of the 40. I've since discovered that we were ahead of the 8th Army, main 8th Army, you see.
And this is Berka, spelled...
B-E-R-K-A.
And that's in Libya?
Yeah, oh yes. It's, I suppose, about 10 miles south of Benghazi.
Now, what were you doing with this detachment at Berka?
What were the planes doing?
What were you all doing? Yes.
Well, I was helping to maintain the service, the radar and the planes. What the planes were up to, I don't know. They went off on operations. I think they were probably after German supply ships, because Rommel was having to be supplied. There was in Benghazi harbour an oil tanker which had caught fire, been bombed and was still burning. We were living in the most primitive conditions.
Now, can you describe the conditions at Berka? What were you living in?
Ridge tents holding, I think, four or six men each.
What were the tents like?
A ridge tent. Maybe about, well, I don't know, about 8 feet by 6 feet, something like that. You couldn't stand upright in them. You had no comfort at all. You slept on the ground, in whatever bedding you had with you. The food was extremely poor. Don't forget where we were then. I mean, we were having at one time corned beef three times a day. Apparently, I think you can stew it, you can fry it, you can bake it, you can casserole it, and it's bloody awful. There was no bread.
The corned beef's particularly inappropriate because it's so salty as well, and it goes liquid in heat.
Yeah, well, there we are. That's what we had. No bread. Potatoes were sweet potatoes, which I loathed then and I still loathe. No fresh veg or fruit. No toilet arrangements of any kind. They fixed up a loo which consisted of a 44-gallon oil drum with the top and the bottom cut off, and it was partly sunk into the ground, and a wooden rod was put across one of the diameters, and you perched on that. If you slipped, well, I don't know.
You didn't.
We were very short of water. One side or the other, you know, the fighting went backwards and forwards, chucked dead bodies down the wells to stop the other side getting.
So how did you manage for water? What was your water supply? Was it brought up from
It was brought up in bowsers from Benghazi somehow, I think, because Benghazi had been captured by them. But I know we were ahead of the 8th Army because I remember the day we were by the road which ran from Benghazi westwards, and the 8th Army came through. It was quite a sight, with all the tanks on their transporters, and all the soldiers and waving at us, and we were waving at them. But I sometimes have thought since, because we were very far ahead of the main contingent, what would have happened if the Germans had come back and I had been captured and they discovered I was circumcised?
A Jewish, in other words.
Yes, would have been quite interesting. The time I never thought about it. Then eventually the main squadron was back in Egypt, and eventually the medical officer was flown up, and he took one look at us and he said, these men have got to be sent back, they'll go mad here. So I was put in a Wellington aircraft to be flown back, and it developed a fault, and we had to land at El Adam. One of the engines developed a fault.
What do you remember of that? Was it a crash landing or just a control?
No. The engine, it landed all right, but it had some kind of a problem with it, so it was okay. they more or less fixed it, but the starter motor wouldn't work. There were big radial engines. The starter motor wouldn't work on this aircraft. And so the most extraordinary thing was done. The propeller, three-bladed propeller, was turned so that one of the blades was vertically downwards. The officer in charge had got hold of a long rope, made a loop at one end, put it over the blade, and put us over there and said, now, when I say, well, I'll be up in the cockpit, when I say go, you all pull. And I thought, very nice, what happens if the loop doesn't come off the propeller? So we all pulled, and to my astonishment, the engine started. We taxied to the end of the, not a runway, but a kind of rolled out airstrip. And the captain then said the other engine had overheated, so we'd have to stop. Turned off both engines. We had to start this one again. I've got an illegal photograph here showing it. Must be unique. So we took off from El Adam on Christmas morning, got back to the main squadron at lunchtime. And this was the thing I was going to tell you about the Australians. Very nice chaps. The air crew had all been were all issued with revolvers and ammunition in case they got shot down. And they were enjoying themselves, seeing how close they could shoot towards their mates without actually hitting them. They were all well tanked up by then, you see. I was terrified.
How close were they getting?
Well, I don't know. I dug a hole in the sand and stayed down there. In that way, they were very unlike the British, but a very likeable lot.
And how were you feeling when you got back, after all? I mean, you'd not been attacked at Birka. It was just very hard life, hard living.
Yeah, but
you hadn't been under air attack or...
No. Well, no, but we were... And one night I was detailed to be the guard on one of the aircraft. Now, you see, the Italians had apparently been putting... We were very close to the coast, and the Italians had been putting men ashore on midget submarines, looking for targets, and if they found an aircraft, for example, they'd apparently attach some plastic explosive to it. So it was decided to guard the aircraft. And... The guarding I had to do was to take my bedding roll, go and settle down inside this Wellington plane with a Bren gun, which I'd never fired, or Sten gun, which I'd never fired in my life and had not the slightest idea how to fire, and lie there guarding the aircraft. And as the night got colder and the plane got colder, all the metal started contracting, and there were continual creaks and grunts and so on, and I was lying there until daylight. But that was how we saved our aircraft.
Now, so what happens next then? Oh, I should ask you, how was your duties going? I mean, you were fitting and repairing the radar for these aircraft. Were they Wellingtons?
Yes.
And were there any problems that you were encountering in service that you weren't expecting or anticipating?
I don't think so.
What were the normal routine things that went wrong, if you see what I mean? Or did they just...
Well, you see, we had to do a daily inspection.
Now, what's a daily inspection?
A DI. All the various trades had to do a DI in their own thing, in their own way. As far as radar was concerned, we had to go and run the radar on the ground and check that it was picking up signals. Now, it needed a special power supply. One had to take a generator on a trolley, a very heavy generator, and take a cable into the aircraft, unless the engine people were doing a DI on one of the engines, in which case they'd be generating the power for the radar. So we normally waited around until they ran an engine. The noise, by the way, was intensely awful. You may notice I'm wearing a hearing aid. My hearing was permanently affected. I didn't realise that at the time, but we were given no kind of ear protection whatsoever. The radar equipment, I've actually been to RAF Colindale, the museum, and measured it. The radar was about a metre and a half away from the port engine, which was a 1,000 horsepower radial engine. And the only thing between, in a Wellington, between you and the engine, if you were inside the aircraft, was the fabric, because the Wellington didn't have a metal skin, had a fabric skin. And it was utterly impossible to talk to anybody. The only way you could make yourself heard at all was to put your mouth literally right against the ear of the other person and shout.
And so that was what you'd set it up, and you'd either have this special method of starting special power supply, or we'd do it during an engine check.
Yes.
And what would fail?
Two kinds of things were most common. One was that the transmitter would wander off frequency, so you'd have to retune it with this wave meter that I referred to earlier on, which was a very heavy device to cart around in aircraft. The other problem was because the receiver used valves, not transistors, they were fairly easily affected by vibration, and the vibration in the aircraft from the engines was pretty intense. I don't just mean ordinary moving around of aircraft, but unlike a jet, which people are used to now, the vibration was really quite intense and didn't do the valves any good at all. It was, by the way, quite awful working inside an aircraft, the temperature and the humidity. It became quite dangerous because one was pouring with sweat, really dripping with sweat, and in order to tune the transmitter, one had to use a tool which connected up with the Lecker lines inside that were at over 20,000 volts. And if you got any of your perspiration on that tool, you could actually be electrocuted. It's highly unpleasant kind of condition. It's very difficult to describe.